How are you ready to proceed, Mr. Wallace?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
I had to make sure I stood standing because otherwise I'd turn right into that wall. I'm not used to coming from this side.
Before you start, and yes. I'll stop the clock while you answer this question.
Yes, sir.
Help me with a procedural question. As I understand it, we have two issues here, the bank employees and the customers.
Yes.
And as I understand the Superior Court's ruling with regard to the bank employees, he was going to reduce the charge, which the state could accept, or grant a new trial as to the bank employees. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the state declined the offer of the reduced charge. So theoretically, the record reads a new trial was ordered for the two bank employees. Is that correct?
Yes.
Under our rules of procedure, when a new trial is granted, the judgment is not final, and it's an interlocutory appeal. And under our rules, under our Constitution, as you know, we can't have an interlocutory appeal in a criminal case. And the site for new trials being interlocutory is Miller versus Suburban Propane. It's a case that's reported. It's a 1989 case. So my question is, if all of that's true, then in today's argument, we really wouldn't be talking about the bank employees.
Your Honor, I think I said yes too quickly. I think we did allow the court to sentence on the aggravated menacing for Ms. Gleason and Mr. Kirk. Those are the only two bank employees
right.
that the charges were reduced for.
So they were.
I recall now, that I believe the letter I sent, and I apologize that I don't have a copy of it with me, but I can double check and confirm that with the court. Said that we would not seek a new trial for them, that we would allow the court to sentence it. But we were not waiving our ability to make this argument because, in effect, the court granted a motion for judgment of acquittal as to the robbery first degree, which under 99902 we could then appeal. Sentence was imposed.
Well, let's see. They're your clients. Do you know if they were sentenced for the two bank employees? Well, I know that's what you'd like to do. I'm trying to tell you that if it's interlocutory, we don't have jurisdiction. All right, well, let's talk about everything, and you sort that out and let us know, okay?
I will, Your Honor. I have their sentencing order, and I believe I have a copy of the indictment with the...
You can send it later.
Thank you. Your Honor, at issue today is how Delaware construes its robbery statute. There really are two schools of thought when different states construe their robbery statutes. Some believe it to be an aggravated theft. Hawaii was one of those types of jurisdictions that was pointed out by the appellees in this case. And then there are those who believe it to be a crime against the person. Delaware is well within that latter group. And it is clear, in fact, from this court's decision in Washington versus State, and really every case that has decided robbery and multiplicity questions coming from this court, that it is a crime against the person, and therefore multiplicity, the multiplicity review is different than in crimes involving property, such as arson or drug dealing.
But doesn't the statute, that is the robbery statute that's at issue here, require that there be a theft? And if it does, then isn't the class of victims restricted to those from whom there was an actual theft or at least an attempted theft of property belonging to them?
I suggest no, Your Honor. As to the first question, it must occur in the course of committing theft. That is the language that is used. And, in fact, the case law in Delaware, and it's quite clear, is that that person need not be the person from whom property is actually taken. In fact, Ross says, for instance, a business's property is taken, but that person happens to be the one threatened to get that property. There must be a causal link. From the time of the code commentary in 1973, it was very clear that there must be a causal link. And when the code commentary speaks about how theft is part of the robbery statute, it made it quite clear that the section doesn't require a taking from the person or from the presence of the person, but there must be a causal link between the use of the threat of force and the theft.
So when is in the course of committing theft, when does that begin and when does that end?
Statutorily now, it begins from the time the person attempts to obtain the property, during escape, because 832 after Dixon was in fact amended to make in the course of committing theft really any action taken in attempting to obtain the property. If in fact this is not linked to the property, then what were they doing in that lobby? There is the causal link between the threat of force to the customers in this case, and that's the state's argument. The threat of force to the customers in this case is to ensure that the theft can take place.
Well, the problem here, I mean, we're talking in the gauziest abstract. The problem here is who are the cognizable victims under the robbery statute, a question that is not answered by the statute itself. Well, and as a consequence of that, we have, on the one hand, the argument by the defense that the class of victims is necessarily narrowed to those who are victims, actual victims of theft, and your side, which argues that it can be anybody who happens to be in the same room. If an aggravated theft, such as a robbery, takes place, and any of those people in the room happen to be threatened or intimidated by the prospect of deadly force.
Well, I'd suggest, Your Honor, that that's a very interesting and a very necessary distinction. They have to be directly threatened. And here they were. And they were directly threatened to ensure that a theft went forward. We already know that the cognizable...
Your answer to my question is yes. That is, the statute does create that very broad class of victims.
Yes, and
even
briefing,
though it
we
doesn't say that.
Well, I suggest that it does, Your Honor, and in fact, the interpretation of the statute by this court has by saying
can you tie your interpretation to the language of the statute?
Yes,
because the statute doesn't really tell us who, which class of people are bona fide. Cognizable victims.
Well, I'd suggest that when it says it uses or threatens immediate use of force upon another person, so any other person, intent.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Wallace, let's suppose that at Dover Downs at a NASCAR event, there's a $100,000 cash prize, and they're delivering it to the winning driver on the infield. Someone comes up with a gun and is going to take the $100,000 suitcase of money from the winning driver, and then on the microphone says to the 100,000 people in the stadium, no one move or do anything while I leave with this money that I've just taken. Have they just robbed 100,000 people?
I don't know that the threat is as individualized as it is, and that's the question. The question is whether
evidence. Because you're telling us these 11 people in our case were robbed. Tell me why every single person in the Dover Downs Stadium who didn't want to be harmed and remained in their seat wasn't robbed.
Because what happened with these 11 people is different than what happens with those 100,000. In this case, the causal link, and it's very close, is that they are actually taken. They are in fact physically taken from one place to another. They have guns immediately held to them, and they are in a position to prevent or overcome the resistance to the taking. And in fact, the co-defendant in this case, Mr. Hunter, said, that's why we did it, to ensure that they didn't alert anybody, to ensure that those people didn't get there. And the acts taken to each and every one of those people, if we go through individually what happened with them, for instance, the Verizon workman, come over here, big eye, he's told. And when they believe that, in fact, he is moving into a cubicle and may, in fact, either call the police or try to do something to stop it, he points the gun again at him and moves him to a different place.
Now, I understand you're arguing then that that the bystanders were robbed because they were put in fear of danger, of the possible deadly force to themselves?
Yes. Okay. They were absolutely put
in fear. And that differentiates this case from Justice Holland's hypothetical, because the 100,000 people who were sitting in the stadium were not in physical, at least were not facing physical danger to themselves, right?
I suggest that they're not.
But
they're not,
but
not
the
sufficiently.
The hypothetical posits that if any of these people move or make any effort to interfere, that the person who is being held at gunpoint would be killed. So in other words, they're, you know, the danger is to somebody else.
And sometimes that also
and the statute, at least the language of the statute, appears to encompass that situation, does it not?
Yes, and in fact, the Harrigan decision of this court said the same thing, where the threat was to one person.
So doesn't the reasoning of your position require you to say that all 100,000 people at Dover Downs who were spectators of this event were robbed?
I suggest no. And the reason I suggest no is the causal link is basically a sufficiency of evidence type question. The state doesn't disagree, actually, with much of what Judge Silverman said in his opinion, as far as that the putative victim has to otherwise be involved in the theft. The question is, what's a sufficient link? And in some situations, for instance, in the Dover Downs, I'd suggest we won't meet that sufficiency of evidence question, because there isn't a sufficient link. The danger isn't close enough. The threat isn't clear enough. And, in fact, they aren't. There's no other action toward them. In a case like this, however, it's very clear. In fact, what we have to prove, one of the things we have to prove that element is that they did it with the intent of preventing or overcoming resistance. It is clear in this case, as the sufficiency of evidence question that the state suggests it is that's exactly what they intended. That's how they planned it. That's how they carried it out. And in fact, the threats were only during the commission of theft from the bank. It began when they started the stealing, when Mr. Bridgers takes the manager back to the vault and the time that he is dealing with the tellers. And this bank is basically, to lay it out for the court, if the bench was, in fact, teller station and the vault is there, all these folks are sitting right here watching this occur with a gun, with a Tech 9 trained on them, so that they can't interfere, so that they can't prevent or overcome.
So and if so someone goes into a bank, applying your proximity analysis, and has a gun and says, nobody move, this is a robbery, the number of robberies being committed is the multiple of all the people who heard that.
Who were actually threatened, yes. And it's a very few, the reason that, now one of the things that, one of the things I do disagree with the Superior Court on is that this is the first time. Actually, this is not an uncommon charging decision by the state. I would agree this is the first time this court has had to make a decision on it. But the state suggests most robberies that we see, luckily, aren't takeover-type robberies like this. Most of them, we know, for instance, Hamilton, decided by the court last week, the person deals only with the employees, really doesn't want everybody else to know what's going on. And in those situations, the customers who are about and don't hear it, aren't threatened in any way, they're not victims. But those people who are individually threatened, we suggest, are. And they are, in fact, victims of robbery, because the person is doing it in the course of committing theft and for the specific purpose of effecting that theft, to ensure they take care of it. That's really the aggravated circumstance of the assault against the person that robbery is.
I understand, Mr. Wells, that in his opinion, Judge Silverman distinguished between the bank employees who were, in effect, dragooned into assisting the perpetrators to commit the robbery, and the bystanders who were simply told to sit down and don't do anything. Is that distinction, a meaningful distinction under your analysis?
I don't believe it matters. I don't believe it is. And in fact, I mean, if in fact we were to start at the classes of victims in this particular case, obviously we have the teller and Ernest Johnson, who is the manager, who is the tellers, Ms. Green, Ms. Natho, Ms. Honey, and Ms. White. They're along the teller line. Ms. Green and Mr. Johnson are taken into the vault and told to give over the money. Now, Ms. Gleason is an interesting case because what happens is that the judge says that there isn't sufficient evidence that she didn't do anything, and yet she's taken from here by gunpoint over to basically the end of the bench.
Well, I asked you whether there's a conceptual, a meaningful conceptual difference between the circumstances of these two groups of alleged victims.
I don't believe there is.
You're not answering that question in conceptual terms, and that's what I'm asking you to do.
In conceptual terms, no, there isn't. Whether they are customer, whether they are employee who doesn't actually give up money, they are, in fact, threatened with force for the purposes of getting that money, no matter whether they're the person handing it over, whether or not they're simply neutralized to ensure that they can't prevent or overcome the resistance. And in fact, that's why they were indicted, Mr. Kirk's situation and Ms. Gleason's situation. The indictment in their case did use the element of preventing or overcoming resistance, because there are different ways that somebody may be a robbery victim. Really, what they would like to do is push it all to, you can't be a robbery victim unless you are compelled to give up the money yourself. You must actually hand it over. And the state suggests that, one, that's
well,
not
in
consistent
effect,
with
in effect, the bank employees were compelled, weren't they?
Five of them were. Ms. Gleason was compelled to go over and tell the tellers to step back. Mr. Kirk was basically compelled to step back, to step
okay,
away.
But then weren't there other employees who were compelled to take money from the vault and put it in,
yes,
empty out the cash register?
Johnson and Green, and then there were three tellers out who also actually handed over money. Now, conceptually, I would suggest that under our construct, there need not be any difference between those employees who didn't actually give over money and the customers. Is there some, and this gets actually
okay, so
into
if
their...
If we were to conclude that the bystanders were not robbed within the meaning of the statute, then neither were the bank employees.
Well, no, there is another doctrine out there.
Ah, there is a distinction. That's
there can be.
Well, that's what I asked you to begin with.
But there can be, and that is the protective concern of employees for their employees' money. To some extent, this court has adopted that in Ross. The court adopted it really last week again, I believe, in Hamilton, although we don't speak in
specific terms. Shifting ground here. I mean, I was trying to get at whether Judge Silverman was right or not right in distinguishing between these two groups. You said, well, there really is no distinction. Now you tell me that there is.
What is it? If the court is asking distinguishing between the two groups, meaning the employees who are the problem is there are three groups, and maybe that's where I'm being imprecise. The three groups are the employees who actually gave over money, actually either went into the vault or gave from the tellers. There are two employees who did neither of those two things, but who were basically corralled. And then there are the customers who are corralled. Now, if the court is asking me, is there a difference between those two who are corralled and the customers who are corralled, I would suggest in our statute there need be no difference.
And the rest of the employees?
Aren't the employees in constructive, actual, every employee is in either actual
yes.
or constructive possession of the cash, which is the object of the robbery, right?
Right.
So doesn't that distinguish the bank employees who are corralled from the customers who are there to make a deposit?
It does, but it doesn't. What I'm saying is under the construction that the state suggests, it doesn't have to. But if the court believes that there should be a distinction between those two, then yes, they were victims of robbery, even under the more limited view, because, yes, they have that protective concern.
Well,
they do have that custody of the money.
It's not whether the court believes that there ought to be a distinction between the two. The question is, what should the court do if it were to conclude that the bystanders were not robbed? doesn't that conclusion compel the additional conclusion that only the bank was robbed?
No. The state suggests
so,
it does not.
So the employees that were dragooned into actually physically assisting the robbers are in a different category.
The other two who didn't do anything otherwise to give up money, if that's what the court's asking, yes, they
well,
can be
let me ask a slightly different way. Let's suppose no one's in the bank except bank employees.
Yes.
Regular business hours. And we have one person that's a teller and four people that are basically customer service, but
yes,
they're in the lobby area. And the person delivering the money is the teller, but the robber says to the customer service people, get over there just as they did to the customer. As I understand your position, because the people that were corralled were bank employees, there were five robberies.
Yes.
But
yes. And I think that's an easier case.
All right.
Because they do, because if the theft, if the causal link to the theft is the concern here, and again, as to sufficiency of evidence of that causal link, they have a greater interest in holding the money and protecting it for their employer.
So under your distinction between the groups, the fact that you have the status of an employee means when one employee is robbed in your presence, all employees are robbed.
If, in fact, they are all threatened, I mean, assuming that those facts, yes.
Right. Well, we've used up all of your time.
I'm sorry. I've only got 1 minute.
Thank you. Good morning.
Afternoon, Your Honor. Afternoon. May it please the Court, Patrick Collins. I represent Keno Critchlow, appellee, and Ms. Walker represents Andre Bridgers. She also represents him on a cross appeal, and we're going to do our best to divide our to divide the allotted time here. this case, it appears, boils down to simply a plain reading of three unambiguous statutes: robbery, theft, and aggravated menacing. All three are equally applicable, but it's important to note that embedded inside the robbery statute is the term theft. The robbery, what makes something a robbery, is when a person is in the course of committing a theft. And we don't need to ponder what the course of committing a theft is because we have a theft statute. And this, the theft statute is very explicit. It's taking or obtaining property from another person, intending to deprive that person of it. And one need look no further than what the plain meaning of the term that person is. So as to the five employees in the bank who are in, let's say, the first of the three categories of all the people here, they were robbed. They were told to give up property. And since they were employees of the bank, they gave up the bank's property. But nevertheless, they were victims of theft. Now, since that theft,
whether they were corralled or participating in turning over cash, whatever.
Well, all those tellers, I think the record is pretty clear that all those five people were somehow involved in delivering up property to Bridgers. So those five people are victims of theft, and since the theft occurred with the use or threat of deadly force, then that...
assume an employee is mixed with the customers who were corralled. Is that a robbery, at least as to that bank employee?
Your Honor, I would suggest that no, it's not, and we actually had that in this case. Mr. Kirk was lumped in with the group of customers. No one asked him for any of the bank's money or asked him in any way to participate in the robbery. What happened is he was menaced. He was, in essence, walked over to the group in the lobby at gunpoint and told to sit with them. But at no point did Bridgers or Hunter say, and by the way, give me your wallet, or And by the way, tell me where the safe is so I can go get some money. That is an example of a person who happens to be an employee of the custodian of the money, but there's no theft. No one asks him, compels him to do anything with regard to delivering a property.
But the force, if he's a custodian of the money, then he's a victim of the theft, isn't he?
I would say no, Your Honor.
What is your bottom line? Is your bottom line that the only victim of the theft is the bank? Or is your bottom line that the victims of the theft are and the robbery are the bank and the employees of the bank who were forced to participate?
The victim of the robberies were the five employees that were forced to participate in the delivering up of property.
All right, but not the bystanders, not the customer bystanders.
Correct. I think it's the best way to term those people would be menaced bystanders.
Are you contending that the Superior Court's decision in this case should be affirmed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So you do think there's a distinction between employees? Because with regard to at least this particular case, the employees were treated differently in the Superior Court's opinion. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. And I think
before you answer that, just so I can be clear, and do you think that the distinction made by the Superior Court was correct?
I think it was correct in this case, because the reasoning for the grant of a new trial, as opposed to changing the convictions to aggravated menacing, was that the jury instructions with regard to those two employees, the court found lacking and imprecise with regard to the custodial relationship between those two, let's call them non-participant employees, and the money. And the courts noted in its opinion that there was not a significant amount of discussion or attention paid to that distinction. And as such, I think it was appropriate for the Superior Court to make the distinction. I would say hypothetically that had the jury instructions been more precise with regard to the custodial relationship, then I would probably be in the camp of saying that those two non-robbed employees should really be in the same category as the nine menaced bystanders.
So your position doesn't differ from the state's at all, correct?
No, it differs significantly, Your Honor.
Except as to the bystanders,
well,
pardon me.
New trial on the issue of a jury instruction as to the two employees, but more importantly as to the bystanders, those menaced bystanders fit perfectly within the statutory definition of aggravated menacing. They were people who were not asked to compel or give up.
But your position is the same as the state's, at least as far as the bank employees are
with concerned. Regard that it was appropriate to order a new trial, yes. However, I think the two bank employees who were not robbed, had there been more precise jury instructions, the defendant should have been found not guilty of robbery as to those two individuals.
Okay.
They could at very likely have been found guilty of aggravated menacing. The distinction being that no one asked them.
Excuse me. Your client's position then does create, in addition to the bank, a separate category of victims of robbery. That is the at least those bank employees that were forced directly or indirectly to give up the bank's money.
They have a possessory interest in their employer's money if they're asked to deliver it.
So it's to that extent there's a multiplicity issue that flows from your position and from the state's as well.
I think there is, Your Honor.
How do you address that?
Well, it's been held in Delaware that there can be two robberies. There was a Radio Shack robbery where the employee was asked to give up property belonging to Radio Shack, the cash register receipts, and then in a separate, let's call it transaction, asked to give up her own personal property. Did not. The holding was that that constituted two separate robberies because, in essence, there were Two separate categories of property, yes.
But that's not involved here. There's only one separate category of property. Why don't we have just one robbery? That is, why doesn't the doctrine of multiplicity compel the conclusion that there could be only one robbery charge?
Well, because I think I agree with the state in the sense that the threat and use of force as to those five tellers who actually went and got money and put them into bags to hand to Bridgers and Hunter were all separate victims. I think the case law is basically clear that there can be multiple victims even if there's only one, let's call it, pot of money.
Well, how do you reconcile that argument with Washington versus State, which requires a separate intent to commit a separate crime, separate violation of the statute, even though the acts that took place occurred within the same framework of time and space?
Your Honor, I think what Washington versus State addresses is not precisely what happened here. In Washington versus State, there were two robberies, but separate and distinct robberies within succession. In other words, there's a temporal difference between the robberies.
Right. One time it was the wallet, one time it was the keys, one time it was the leather jacket.
And here there's no temporal difference. It all happened at the same time.
Right.
So you have five individuals who were being compelled to give up property.
Same property, all at the same time, all in the same place. How does that, isn't that the opposite of Washington?
It is, but, you know, my understanding is the subject of the state's appeal is as to the people who were, the five people who were robbed at the bank are separate and distinct from the menaced individuals. I think the difference between this case and Washington is that Washington holds there can be multiple robberies when a person goes back and robs the person again. If you look at the specific language of the theft statute, each individual was a person who was compelled to deliver up property. In other words, that person within the meaning of the statute. However, as to the nine individuals who were victims of aggravated menacing and the two bank employees, it's Mr. Critchlow's position that the Superior Court should be affirmed as to those individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Ms. Walker.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I represent Mr. Bridgers on the as the appellee and cross-appellant. First, to address Your Honor's question regarding the sentences, I did check, and it appears that Mr. Bridgers was sentenced on the two aggravated menacings for the two that the court was concerned with.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, I differ from both gentlemen in that it is our position that there was only one robbery total. There were the customers who were aggravated, who were menaced, then the employees. And the way we can show in this particular case why
now,
the...
This is your cross-appeal, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And, in Mr. Wallace's brief, he raises two points about your cross-appeal. First, this matter wasn't fairly presented. And second, it's contrary to settled Delaware law. So with regard to the first, tell us how it was fairly presented. With regard to the second, if it is contrary to Delaware law at the present time, then do we have to go en banc to decide your cross appeal?
To answer your first question, it was not raised below. However, this court held in Handy versus State, where the court found only one arson when there were two victims, and in Williams versus State, where the court found two stashes of drugs was one possession with intent to deliver. Both of those were reversed under a plain error standard. Additionally, with respect to the prior case law by this court, the case law, I would argue, is not precedential with respect to this in that in Ross versus State, which is the particular case that the state relies on, was a 26C format with a motion to affirm, and there was no real discussion regarding the actual case law that we're discussing today. Additionally, in Poteet versus State, I believe, the court reversed a prior decision under the basis that it had not addressed the commentary of the robbery statute at that time.
Well, how can it be plain error with the precedents that exist?
It's plain error as it goes to a constitutional issue of multiplicity, Your Honor. Mr. Bridgers actually engaged in only one course of conduct. And in Washington versus State, this court held that one course of conduct equals one count. And even if the statute's not clear whether it should be multiple counts from one statute or not, the court also held that the court must rule in favor of one count. Now, the court has discussed...
So the distinction you're making, in our prior cases, if you lined up three people and you said to them, give me your property, that would clearly be three robberies. But here, because we have multiple bank tellers that all work for the same bank, and we'll say it's the bank's money, is that the distinction you're drawing to say it's one robbery because although three people surrendered, multiple people surrendered money, it was all the bank's money?
Yes, Your Honor, there was one theft. And if the court were to look at some of the other jurisdictions, in fact, the state addressed the fact that some of those statutes read taking from another or the presence of another, and I would argue that that language actually broadens their interpretation. The courts in those jurisdictions said there can be a robbery conviction for each teller as they were custodians. Some jurisdictions still actually interpreted as just one robbery, but they interpreted the word presence of another as custodial value. In our jurisdiction, that term is not used. There is no distinction between someone who has custody or someone whose property it is. Therefore, there can still only be one robbery. If, in particular with respect to the customers, if the state tried to charge Mr. Bridgers with one count of theft and one count of aggravated menacing for each individual customer, they wouldn't be able to survive on that. And since robbery is theft plus aggravated menacing, they simply cannot they cannot succeed on that.
Your position, which is that there's only one robbery victim here, you argue, and tell me if I have this right or not, is compelled for two reasons. One, because that's a proper interpretation of the statute. And secondly, even if the statute could be read to create broader classes of victims, the multiplicity doctrine forbids that. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, this court in Dixon versus State found that our jurisdiction interprets the robbery statute more narrow than the model penal code, which is analogous to the one jurisdiction that the state could even find that went the other direction. So
on the other hand, our statute does could be read exactly to meet exactly what Mr. Wallace claims it reads.
It could be, and that's broad, and that's why this court actually stated, I believe it was in Poteet versus State, that even if the legislative intent was not clear as to whether it should be read broadly or not, the court must hold that there can't be separate sentences for an individual.
But wasn't the statute amended after Dixon?
It was after Dixon, that's correct, although that addressed only that particular situation. It wasn't amended to broaden the entire scope of the statute.
But, you know, as you have commendably done, you concede that the statute could be read as broadly as Mr. Wallace chooses to read it. Doesn't it follow from that there is no plain meaning of the statute that would compel us to come out the way that you argue for, at least as a matter of pure statutory construction?
Well, if the court wants to look to the plain meaning, the problem with that in this particular case is the absurd result that comes from it, as Justice Holland actually pointed out. And for the state to say in Justice Holland's hypothetical that there is no direct link, it doesn't make sense with what they're arguing here today. Of course there's a direct link if you're holding a gun to some person and saying, if you don't stay in your seats, I'm going to shoot you. There has to be a direct link. If that's not their argument, where does the line get drawn? Had Mr. Bridgers and Mr. Hunter stood at the door of the bank and waved people off from coming in, are they victims of robbery? The hypothetical in Mr. Bridges' brief was that there were people up on a balcony while he was robbing someone. Are they victims of robbery? So the problem here is it can just lead to absurd results, and that cannot be what the legislature intended.
So that way you're arguing that the outcome that the interpretation that you're arguing for is the proper, sensible interpretation, but again, it's not compelled by the plain language of the statute.
Well, it is true it could be read broadly. However, the state's contention with respect to the causal connection, I believe, is incorrect. The causal connection has to be one entity, one location, one time, one intent. There was one intent in this particular case, and I think that's what the robbery statute's targeted at. There's one intent, and that's to rob PNC Bank of money.
That sounds like multiplicity analysis being sneaked in through the back door to, as a matter of statutory interpretation.
Well, if the court wants to look at the absurd result that comes from the strict interpretation of the statute, yes, that is possible.
I mean, the question is, because of the way the statute is drafted, to get to the result that you're arguing for, if purely as a matter of statutory construction, there has to be something to tether that language in a way that creates only one victim, at least in these circumstances. And the argument, the tether that you were arguing for in your brief, if I understand it right, was that there has to be a theft. That is, that all of these enumerated subclauses have to be referring to people who were victims of the theft.
That's correct.
But the statute doesn't say that.
No, but I think it does go back to the absurdity of that type of an interpretation, and that's a well-established statutory construction argument. And in Handy versus State, for example, the defendant in that case set one fire with two intended victims. And if you read that statute word for word, that could have resulted in different.
But we're told that was an arson case.
Yes.
And arson is a crime against the property.
Yes.
And that's how the court disposed of the argument that there were two arsons. The same, Delaware case law makes it clear that robbery is a crime against the person.
It does. But what Poteet does is it actually distinguishes between the addressing the physical harm that robbery addresses as well, simply without the theft. And we're not asking that these people go free. We're saying this is aggravated menacing because that addressed the same harm that robbery does. It just does not require theft.
What distinguishes the corralled group with the bank employees from the bystanders?
Nothing.
Well, why aren't they distinguished by the fact that they're also custodians of the property that's being taken?
My time is up. Would you like me to answer? Well, first of all, the ones that are corralled are not in custody and not being forced to actually turn over the money. And then the ones that are the actual tellers.
But they're being forced to assist in the robbery by standing still.
Just as the customers are. They're not involved any further than the customers are. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wallace, we asked you a lot of questions. I've reset the clock. You can have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. First, I agree as to the sentencing. They were sentenced. I was checking our paperwork. Secondly, as to Ross versus State, that wasn't decided under 26C. That was actually decided under a motion to affirm. In fact, in that case, in Ross, there was one Holiday Inn. Its money was taken. Two employees were threatened, and this court said, two robbery convictions are appropriate, and not only that, agreed with the state that it was so clear that it granted the state's motion to affirm. So it was fully briefed by the defendant in that case. I suggest this, Your Honor, that the real question here is, what is the causal link that there needs to be between the threat to the people and the theft that is occurring? The appellees and cross-appellants want to say, they have to be the victims directly of the theft. That's not what the code commentary says when the robbery statute was, in fact, enacted. And if that is true, and one of the hooks, and I think one of the hooks that both the Superior Court uses and that the appellees try to use is, but they're still aggravated menacing. Well, then before 1995, what were these people? They were victims of nothing because there was no aggravated menacing. And if you look at the history of aggravated menacing, it certainly wasn't to come forward with a lesser-included offense of robbery to cover those victims. In fact, if you look at the history of it and you look at the synopsis of it, and we've cited the bill itself, it was
victims of terroristic threatening.
It was actually reckless endangering, Your Honor, because what happened was if you held a gun at somebody, you also have, and we would charge reckless endangering, we may not be able to meet the element of creating a substantial risk of death because you had to prove it was loaded and things like that. So it was actually to address that, and that's what the synopsis of the bill says. I would ask the court to think of it in these terms. Think of these victims, these folks who are sitting out here, just like the mother and the father and the grandmother in Harrigan. Why? Because what is going on is, as they're having, or I'm sorry, the son in Harrigan, and these would be the mother and the grandfather, as the gun is held on them, why are they doing it in a bank situation such as this? They are doing that, one, to ensure that they don't do anything to stop it, to prevent or overcome the stealing of the money. Mr. Carey himself said, I thought about doing something, but they had a gun on me. Other people said, I didn't do anything because they had a gun on me. But what else is going on? Those tellers know that there's a gun held on their customers and they're going to give up the money. They are in that same situation. It's just like holding the gun on the son in Harrigan. It forces the theft. There is a causal link. They made the causal link in this case. And all of our statutory law and all of the case law about it says that there does not need to be a direct theft from them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank all of you. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.